Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the wrangling in the Iraqi parliament, where Iraq's president has chosen a new prime minister, Haider al-Abadi, to replace Nouri Maliki, but he appears to be reluctant to relinquish his post in spite of mounting pressure from the US and much of the world for him to step down. Joining us is Flint Leverett, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council in the George W. Bush administration until resigning over Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. We will discuss Iran's role in the shuffling of the deck in Baghdad and whether Iran still wants the state of Iraq to stay together, given that it appears to be falling apart, and the extent to which Iran would have influence over a rump oil-rich Shiite state in the south. Then we will speak with the leading scholar and public voice on Islam, Dr. Khalid Abu El Fadl, who is a distinguished professor of Islamic law at the University of California, Los Angeles, where he is also the chair of the Islamic Studies program. He is the author of The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, and a new book out soon, Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. We will get a profile on who the self-proclaimed Caliph Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is and who might be behind the rise of this street thug into the leader of the so-called Islamic State that controls much of Iraq and Syria and threatens the Kurds in the north and the Shia in the south. Then finally, we will assess the possibility that a joint humanitarian effort by Russia, Ukraine, and the EU, led by the International Red Cross, could be the beginning of a way out of the spiraling violence in eastern Ukraine, where major cities are under siege and millions are displaced. Alexander Motel, a professor of political science at Rutgers University and author of The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism from 1919 to 1929, joins us to discuss whether fears that Putin was planning to use a humanitarian convoy as a pretext for an invasion of eastern Ukraine have been put to rest by this apparent deal. And joining us now is Flint Leverett, who's a professor at Pennsylvania State University School for International Affairs and a visiting scholar at Pekin University School of International Studies. From 1992 to 2003, he served as a senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He, along with his wife, Hilary Mann, are the authors of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Needs to Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Flint Leverett.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me back again.
And Flint, what's your sense then of this wrangling that's going on? My understanding is that that the Iranians basically have a lot of influence over Maliki and over the Dawa Party, and his replacement, Maliki's replacement, is apparently a close colleague, Haider al-Abadi, and a member of the Dawa Party, yet Maliki appears to be pretty truculent.
Yeah, I would say two things on that. One, I would actually be a little bit cautious at this point at thinking that Haider al-Abadi has necessarily displaced Maliki. I mean, what has happened is that the president of Iraq has asked the body to basically to see if he can form a parliamentary coalition, a majority coalition that would endorse him as prime minister instead of Maliki. And that process is still going to unfold. Maliki at this point is making it clear he is going to contest it. He's also apparently going to the Iraqi equivalent of the Supreme Court to challenge the legality of Abadi's nomination to see if he can form the next government. So I don't think this is a done deal yet that Abadi has displaced Maliki. In terms of the Iranian role, I mean, it is certainly true that Iran has substantial influence over the Dawa Party, Mr. Maliki's party, and Mr. Abadi's party. It has great influence over basically all of the Shia Islamist parties. Many of these parties started as opposition groups, opposition to Saddam Hussein. The Islamic Republic supported many of these groups in exile, in opposition to Saddam. And when Saddam was overthrown, these groups, these parties, they came back to Iraq, and they became basically the most important political players in Iraqi politics. And Iran has very, very good relationships with all of them, with virtually all of the major figures in each of these parties. They have a very strong relationship with Maliki. I'm sure they have a strong relationship with Abadi. And I think, though, that it's wrong. It's a little bit off to think of the Iranians as basically picking winners and losers in these battles. I think the Iranians are very, very careful basically to make sure that they always have options, that essentially whoever would be able to put together a majority coalition in the parliament that would enable him to become the next prime minister of Iraq, whether it's Mr. Maliki or whether it's somebody else, is going to be someone almost by definition that the Iranians have a good working relationship with. And so they try not to basically be in a situation where they've put all their eggs in one basket, you know, staked everything on one particular candidate. I mean, formally, the position of Iran is that Maliki and his party won the last parliamentary election, and Maliki should, you know, be the person who tries to form the next government. And at least as of now, I think that's still Mr. Maliki's intention.
Well, I spoke yesterday, Flint, with Bob Baer, the former CIA officer in charge of the Kurdish North, starting from the first Gulf War. And he's sort of mystified as to why we still cling to the idea that we can stand up a unity government there, and that essentially we broke Iraq. And that's what, after all, is what the Secretary of State Colin Powell, apparently the only dissenting voice that Bush ever listened to, warned him of the pottery barn analogy, that if you break it, you own it. Well, we've disowned it. We've walked away, left hundreds of thousands of people dead, trillions of treasury wasted, and a country that's roiling in agony. And so why is it then that Iran, the United States, and even Turkey still apparently want to maintain what appears to be a kind of fiction that you can stand up a unity government?
Well, I think for in the critique of U.S. policy toward Iraq, I think there's enormous validity to that. The United States says it supports a unitary Iraq, and yet, even before the invasion of 2003, when Saddam was overthrown, the United States, for the last 20 or 25 years, has been pursuing policies which have progressively undermined, you know, any potential national unity in Iraq. And I think there's a real strategic incoherence there in American policy, cutting across multiple administrations of both parties. One reason the United States says that it still supports a unitary Iraq is because basically none of Iraq's neighbors, you know, whether those are countries that the United States has close alliances with, like Turkey, or whether it's a country like Iran that the U.S. has strained relations with, you know, everyone in the neighborhood says it doesn't want to see Iraq broken up. And, you know, the United States, you know, makes noises like it respects that. From an Iranian standpoint, I think the reason why Iran would like to see Iraq stay together is that, okay, the majority of the population in Iraq is Shia. It's at least 60% Shia. And while you could, in theory, create this Shia majority state in southern Iraq, where most of the oil is, it would be this very oil-rich state, a fairly prosperous, a fairly populous state. There are also Shia, though, who live throughout Iraq. There are Shia who live when in provinces where they're not the majority of the population. And if you broke up Iraq, you know, you would be, the status of those Shia would be much more exposed, much more at risk. I think also from a geopolitical standpoint, you know, if you're worried about, you know, what can happen in the Sunni majority parts of Iraq where you have this ISIS state taking root, you know, if you're worried about that in a context in which Iraq is still at least nominally unitary, you know, why would you think that's going to be better? You know, if you actually break up Iraq, you know, that problem isn't going to get better. It could in significant ways get worse from an Iranian standpoint. And so both in terms of, you know, wanting to, you know, not see Shia political gains, post-Saddam political gains eroded in Iraq, and also just in terms of the geopolitics and the problems that could come up in non-Sunni and non-Shia majority parts of Iraq, I think the Iranians think it's better to try and manage those problems with Iraq as a unitary state than not.
Again, I'm speaking with Flint Leverett, who's a professor at Pennsylvania State University School for International Affairs and a visiting scholar at Peking University's School of International Studies. From 1992 to 2003, he served as a senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. And together with his wife, Hillary Mann, they are the authors of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Needs to Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. So clearly, Flint, if Iran ends up with in dominating or having, you know, considerable influence over a rump oil-rich state in the south, and the Kurds continue on their trajectory of independence with the oil, which they at this point are not allowed to sell, at least the U.S. is not allowing them to sell. Meanwhile, of course, IS or Islamic ISL, ISIL or whatever you want to call them, apparently they're selling their oil on the black market. But the bottom line is that whatever this Islamic State is, the Sunni entity is, it won't have those resources. But my suspicion is that I don't think that this is all just some crazy street thug turned into a caliph who is behind all of this stuff. There's got to be some intelligence. You know, a street thug can't be having the kind of success this guy's had. It feels to me like there's some sort of state actor behind this. And
no, I think it is a big mistake to read the Islamic State movement as just basically a bunch of thugs. I think these guys, they are very smart, and they have a political program, an expansionist political program that aims to create, you know, a state that actually controls an ever-expanding amount of territory. They have a political program that is, you know, by orders of magnitude more developed than anything Al-Qaeda ever came up with. I mean, these guys are in serious business, not just from a military or we might say a terrorist standpoint. They are in serious business politically. They are out to build a different kind of state in the heart of the Middle East that will take over more and more territory. And they have a very, very sophisticated program. I think that they have gotten support from a number of different sources, including some of our so-called allies. You know, there's been a lot of financial support, at least, that's come out of Saudi Arabia, some Gulf Arab states, for the Islamic State. Turkey has been supportive of them at various junctures. So they do have external support. It is a transnational movement. You know, it's not overwhelmingly Iraqi at all. There's a, you know, important figure in the movement who's a Chechen from Russia. There are Uyghurs from China who are fighting in it. There are people from all over the Arab world, really all over the Muslim world, who have come to join this this cause. So it is not just a bunch of thugs. This is a serious movement with serious external support and a transnational base.
Well, that leads you then, Flint Lever, to try and figure out what the Saudi motive was, assuming that they're the main players behind this. Now, clearly at this point, they've cut across the so-called Shia Crescent. They have isolated Iran from, to some extent, from Syria and from Hezbollah. But at a default position, I would suggest that at the very least, this place is going to be a roiling mess for a long time. It'll certainly destabilize the area and limit Iran's influence. So, you know, whether or not they can win, whatever they want to win, I'm not sure. But it sort of smells to me like Al-Qaeda 2.0, that the Saudis have surreptitiously put this thing together without fingerprints, and where I think we're not up to speed on this, are we?
Oh, no. I think we have been, you know, behind the curve on this. I mean, we have our own hand to play in the creation and growth of what is now the Islamic State. You know, everyone talks about what a great idea the surge was in Iraq in 2007, 2008. But basically what the surge amounted to was training, U.S. training for 80,000 you know, Sunni militants of various descriptions. And we, while we were training them, we paid them $300 a month each, so that basically they wouldn't kill Americans during the period while we were training them. But we helped to feed what is now ISIS in a big way with the surge. And then after the unrest started in Syria in March 2011, and, you know, Saudi money, Gulf Arab money started flowing to this group, ostensibly so they could, you know, fight the Syrian government under President Assad, we basically turned a blind eye to all of this. We wanted to see the Syrian opposition supported. We wanted to see President Assad overthrown. And these guys were the most capable fighters in that arena. And so if our so-called allies were supporting these guys, that was fine with us. And now, certainly for us, and I think there's a good chance for the Saudis, you know, this movement has you know, kind of slipped the leash and is no longer really responsive to, you know, some of the places from which it got early support.
So at this point, though, clearly going after the Kurds is a bridge too far for the U.S., right? I mean, and furthermore, as you start to bomb these people, they're going to become heroes, aren't they? At this moment, they're villains because of their hideous behavior. But at a certain point, you just feed into their jihadist narrative, don't you?
Oh, of course. I mean, nothing will rehabilitate these guys like getting bombed by the United States. That's absolutely right.
So what is, you know, obviously we never ever, whether we wake up to what the Saudis are up to or not, we certainly never, at least in public, ever point the finger at them, and probably rarely do in private. So
I think that's right. Yeah.
So what do we do here? I mean, what's your recipe?
I think that we have to realize that the biggest mistake that we have made, and the 2003 invasion is a major manifestation of this, but it's not the only manifestation of it, is basically to think that we can micromanage political outcomes in a place like Iraq, whether by deciding who we arm, who we don't arm, you know, to whom do we provide close air support, to whom do we not provide close air support, you know, that we can use these kinds of crude tools and micromanage political outcomes in a society that's this complicated. You know, this is not just it doesn't work. It is grossly self-damaging and counterproductive for American interests. You know, the demographics of Iraq are such that in any kind of representative political order, the major political players are going to be first and foremost Shia Islamists and secondly Kurdish parties. That's just where the demographics are. Sunnis in Iraq are probably at this point, they would be 20% of the population at best, at most. And so we have got to understand that the elected governments of Iraq, every government elected in Iraq since Saddam Hussein was overthrown, has been a coalition of Shia Islamists and Kurds. We may not like that. We may not like that these guys are all friends of Iran or others that we don't like, but that is the reality. And if you want to try and maintain some semblance of order in this part of the Middle East, you have to be willing to work with the governments that are there, the governments that are actually rooted there. Work with them, quit trying to undermine them, quit withholding support or cooperation with them until Maliki goes and decide, you know, who you think should replace Maliki. You know, the United States, you know, messed up Iraq by trying to play those games, and it can only make things worse if it continues to play them.
Well, Flint Lever, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks again.
Again, I've been speaking with Flint Leverett, who's a professor at Pennsylvania State University School of International Affairs and is a visiting scholar at Peking University School of International Studies. From 1992 to 2003, he served as senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. Together with his wife, Hillary Mann, they're the authors of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Needs to Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about who this Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl, who is a distinguished professor of Islamic law at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law, where he's also chair of the Islamic Studies program. He was named a Carnegie Scholar in Islamic law and served on the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom and on the board of directors for Human Rights Watch. His books include The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, The Search for Beauty in Islam, and his latest out soon is Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl.
Oh, thank you.
And clearly what is happening in the north of Iraq has alarmed a lot of people around the world, and I imagine Muslims more so than any, because, you know, you keep hearing the phrase Muslim extremists, Sunni extremists, etc. So, you know, by default, the entire religion is being vilified and desecrated by the Islamic State.
Right. Well, it's not whether it's Islamic or state on both points. So I think it's rather contestable. The fact is, very little is known about this group of people. And from the public speeches they've given, or their imam who's given a few Friday sermons and so on, and the way of operating, it's quite clear that they cling to Islamic symbolism, and they, in many ways, have a strong ethnic pro-Sunni identity. They're primarily very hostile to Shia and Kurds who are also Sunnis, Sunni Muslims, but not Arabs, very hostile to Persians, very hostile to other ethnic minorities, even from the Sunni sect of Islam, very hostile to Shias, of course, all of them, without exception. They remind me a lot of the emergence of the Wahhabi movement in Arabia, which tended to operate in very much the same way, a very sort of shoot-from-the-hip Islamic ideology or Islamic set of symbolisms, and a high level of intolerance, very puritanical, and primarily preoccupied with the idea of heresy and purification of, which really means elimination of all elements of diversity and discourse in society and plurality in society. The scariest thing about them is that we really do not know who is behind them precisely. It would clearly not Iran, because that would not be in Iran's interest, since they are very anti-Shia. And there are various indicators that Saudi Arabia might be behind them as a way of destabilizing the Shia influence and Iranian influence in Iraq. And also as a way of further undermining the whole Arab Spring, which they've succeeded in undermining. And then variety of rumors, I'm sure you've seen the articles that were circulating about Israeli connections and so on and so forth.
Well, in terms of this self-proclaimed caliph, his original name was Ibrahim al-Badri, and he spent 4 years in Camp Buker as a prisoner of the United States Army, and he came out of those 4 years as Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, but he was apparently, according to the Pentagon, when they rolled him up in 2004, he was a street thug. So he made this journey from a street thug to a religious pretender, if you will. But what I find extraordinary about him is that apparently he grew up in a poor family in a farming village near Samarra, and that his family was Sufi, which is a very tolerant form. So how much do you think the prison experience brutalized this person?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually also met Iraqis from Samarra, Iraq, who knew his family and knew him, and what they've told me is that this particular kid was known as a troublemaker in the neighborhood, and was sadistic, torture animals, and that people thought of him as emotionally imbalanced already. So I'm not surprised that the Sufi orientation of the family did not rub off on him and did not have much of an impact. Now, of course, with someone like that, you already take a person who has serious emotional problems and you treat them in a highly radicalizing environment. You only compound their psychotic tendencies manifold. And that is, I mean, I've listened to a Friday sermon that he gave, I believe it was in Mosul, and what quite clear from this Friday sermon is that he, A, is very poorly educated. It was not eloquent Arabic, and it was not, he made mistakes in quoting Quran and quoting prophetic traditions. It was highly imitative, and it's clear he's seen or heard other lectures and he was trying to imitate the style, but you can always tell a real master of the art from a pretender. And but see, he's had a unusual and rather, seemed to me, near obsessive interest in obedience and the idea of not being slighted and not being insulted by someone disobeying him. And the final point is that is an utter complete, again, which you find in narcissistic, psychotic narcissistic personalities, nearly doesn't differentiate between himself and God in the speech I've heard. I mean, he often talk about the will of God and his own will is interchangeable, basically, as if he has the... So there is no question that every time we... I mean, to be quite frank with you, every time we send a missile that kills people, or every time we arrest people and mistreat them in places like Guantanamo or Bagram Air Base or whatnot, we're constant radicalization element. We're constantly taking a bad situation and making it much, much worse.
Yeah, and you can add Camp Buka to that list. But again, let me remind the audience I'm speaking with Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl, who's a distinguished professor of Islamic law at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law, where he's also chair of the Islamic Studies program. He was named a Carnegie Scholar in Islamic Law and served on the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom and on the Board of Directors for Human Rights Watch. His books include The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, The Search for Beauty in Islam, and his latest out soon is Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. So in terms of what you were telling us there, what you alluded to, Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl, and frankly, it makes a lot of sense to me. I don't believe that this organization could be run by this street thug, obviously a psychotic and ruthless and not well-educated person who hasn't really made any kind of evolution. By the sound of what you're telling us from his sermons, he's just pretending to burnish his religious credentials, if you will. There's got to be some more to this organization. It's taken over so much territory, and I do feel that there's something behind it, that a big missing element. And could it be that the Saudis are repackaging Al-Qaeda, and now that this, you know, Al-Qaeda has actually disowned this group, the Islamic State. Do you think that there is an intelligence behind this, given this guy, Baghdadi, is not particularly intelligent?
There has to be, because you already, in many situations, we've seen this group go to battle with people that have been fighting the Syrian army for quite a long period of time. So they're battle-hardened people, and they have not been defeated by the Syrian army or even groups that have clans or tribal groups in Iraq, which posed the problem even for the American army when they were in Iraq. But they function surprisingly in terms of the military tactics and also in terms of their armaments. So they seem to be extremely well armed and coordinated, as if they are simply a proxy group for someone. And now, often I think history is extremely instructive. In the past, we find numerous newspaper articles and so on that talked about the Sharif rebellions against the Ottomans and their remarkable successes against the Ottoman empires. And back then, people would write articles and speculate that could it possibly be that the British are behind these rebellions? And other people would write saying, "Oh, you're just full of conspiracy theories. Don't be ridiculous." The same phenomena we saw with the Wahhabi rebellion. People had speculated, and there were at the time various speculations that maybe the French are behind them, maybe the Dutch are behind them, maybe the British are behind them. And then it turned out to be the British who were behind the Wahhabi rebellions. And these, of course, were at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, which led to the establishment of Saudi Arabia. Now, so here again, we have a similar phenomena where suddenly a group sprouts from nowhere, led by a someone who is not rooted within their family, very much like Muhammad Abdul Wahhab, who was alienated from his family, and his mother wrote a book criticizing him. And we have someone who does not have a solid reputation within the neighborhood, and his contemporaries who knew the family and knew that he had problems with his own family. Someone who's been in our custody, I mean, or the custody of security forces, in Western security forces or the like, for a good portion of his life, and on the unhealthy, to say the least, unhealthy mental conditions for a good portion of his life, and yet we find this group working with effectiveness that is disproportionate to militarily, to it just doesn't mathematically add up. And I wouldn't be surprised at all that we would discover, looking back into history, that it would become very well known that they were funded and organized and chaperoned by particular agencies. In terms of who gains from this movement, now everyone knows, and let me be just very clear about this, that everyone knows that this guy establishing a caliphate, it's not as simple as someone just calling themselves a caliph and voila, you have a caliphate. I mean, people, just again, history is very instructive. After the collapse of the Ottoman caliphate, there was a huge Islamic conference in 1924, I believe, or 1923, and Muslim countries got together and they couldn't agree on recognizing a caliphate that to succeed the Ottoman caliphate. So even if this guy declares it the caliphate, to date no one has even in any way recognized the legitimacy of this caliphate in terms of religious institutions, governments, scholars, respected, even just religious leaders, so on. So it is also, when we look at what he's doing, then he's not establishing effective administrative infrastructure. So it seems to be all about warfare, not about building some type of civil structure that could survive the warfare. In terms of immediate goals, he is breaking before all of this started, breaking what Saudi Arabia and Egypt would often refer to as the Shi'i Crescent, from Iran to Iraq to Syria to Hezbollah and Lebanon. So he's both in Syria and Iraq, he's challenging this Shi'i Crescent and contributing to the breakup of nation states, particularly nation states based on any democratic type of system, which had been an anathema to Saudi Arabia and especially United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia since the start of the Arab Spring. So then people can fill in the blanks. So it's clear someone is behind them. It's clear that anyone that knows this fellow knows that this is just a thug who's basically performing a role and not doing it quite well. And there are short-term strategic goals, but long-term, I've read some articles, people saying, oh, you know, is the caliphate coming back and so on. It does not in any way represent a return of the caliphate. It just represents someone using a group of, unfortunately, young people to achieve short-term, immediate goals for their own benefits at the high cost of human life. But that's it.
So, Dr. Khalid Abu El Fadl, then I'm trying to figure out what the strategy would be here. I understand that IS, the Islamic State, has essentially cut the so-called Shia Crescent in two. They're both in Syria and in Iraq, but they control a lot of territory, but they don't control any resources. The Kurds have the oil, and the Shia in the south have the oil. And if the country does break up, Iran will end up with the Shia part, where there's an enormous amount of oil, and that will just make Iran even more powerful. The Kurdish state and the republic has already moved towards independence, and it's becoming economically viable, so it'll be strengthened. What will these radicals in IS, what will they end up with? And what will Saudi Arabia end up with if indeed they're using these people as proxies?
Well, in terms of what they actually achieve, they've disrupted the Maliki government, which in the opinion of many people is under heavy influence by Iran, and they've disrupted Iran's serious network with the Shia-dominated government in Iraq. Now, of course, one result of this is that they're also compromising the integrity of Iraq itself as a nation. They've led to a great deal of chaos among the various Sunni rebels to the point that no one talks about the democratic movement in Syria anymore. I mean, it wasn't that long ago when these massive demonstrations would go out in Syria demanding bread and freedom. And these were the sort of two slogans that inspired the initial rebellion in Syria. It would lead to a region in which, if they had a state, and let's imagine that it's actually a state that will manage to preserve its coherence somehow, they would be in a constantly warring engagements and dynamics with the Kurds, with the Shia on both sides, the Shia in Iraq, and depending on what happens with Syria, including Hafez al-Assad's government, they would perhaps have amicable relations with the Saudi side of the border. But that's it. So they basically would be in constant friction with everyone around them, and they would be fundamentally a war state. Now, which means further chaos, but in whose interest? I mean, and this is the question that I always ask myself. I mean, this complete deconstruction of the whole region and the crumbling of the whole region, and the deterioration of the region into little warring sectarian factions. Who benefits from this? And we can. There's a lot that one can learn from watching Saudi interventions in Yemen, Saudi interventions in Bahrain, sort of the course that the United Arab Emirates has taken for itself. I mean, at this point, the only coherent part that's in the region that's maintaining its integrity is the Arab Gulf countries, which 20 years ago or 30 years ago, nearly all political analysts would have said these are the least viable countries. And that's a remarkable turn of events.
Well, Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl, we've run out of time, but I do want to revisit you soon to talk about your new book, Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age, because it's clearly been vilified, and you have these ridiculous Midwestern states passing laws to outlaw something that they don't understand. And your book is really talks about Sharia, what it really means, and also a way it can be revitalized and re-engage contemporary Islam. So I'm very interested in that conversation.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Very welcome.
Bye-bye. And I was just speaking then with Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl, who's a distinguished professor of Islamic law at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law, where he's also chair of the Islamic Studies program. He was named a Carnegie Scholar in Islamic Law and served on the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom and on the board of directors for Human Rights Watch. His books include The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, and The Search for Beauty in Islam. And his latest book out soon is Reasoning with God, Reclaiming Sharia in the Modern Age. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about whether or not humanitarian aid to eastern Ukraine could lead to a peace deal. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alexander Motl, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empire, and theories. He is the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and his latest book is The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Motl.
Thanks for having me.
And Alexander, what's your understanding of this deal that's been struck between Russia, Ukraine, and the EU, where the International Red Cross is supposed to lead an effort to bring humanitarian aid, into these besieged cities in eastern Ukraine? Is this the beginning, or could this beginning of be the beginning of a peace deal, or is this, as NATO has feared, that Russia wants to use humanitarian aid as a pretext for an invasion?
Well, you put your finger on the problem. It all depends on what Vladimir Putin decides, that he wants to do. Ostensibly, Russia has agreed to supply humanitarian assistance, as you said. Ukraine insists that the 300 or so trucks that Russia apparently has prepared for this deliver the goods to the people in distress and not to the terrorists that the Ukrainian army is fighting. At the same time, the Red Cross insists that there be absolutely no military convoy associated with the humanitarian assistance. In other words, that this simply be a civilian undertaking. Now, if all sides, that is to say, if Russia actually sticks to this particular deal, let's say it sends in water, milk, food, and all sorts of other things, deposits the stuff, and then returns back to Russia, well, that's good. And that might mean that Mr. Putin is embarking on a new tactic. Maybe he's seeking some kind of peace deal. Perhaps he's simply trying to buy time. It's not clear, of course, because we don't know what he wants. But nevertheless, that would be a positive signal of sorts. On the other hand, it's perfectly possible, considering his track record over the last several months, that this will be an attempt to smuggle in weapons to the militants, that some of the foodstuffs may be redirected to them, and so on. And of course, we don't know, the people driving the trucks. I mean, these will be Russians. Will they be Russian soldiers? Well, they're not supposed to be armed, but they might be armed. What if there is some kind of altercation with one of the Ukrainian military forces that could easily lead to an escalation, at which point Putin would say, well, we tried, but the Ukrainian fascists resisted once again. What else can we do but invade? So we don't know, as I said, but potentially this may mean something good, or alternatively, this could turn into a disaster. That, alas, is the track record of Mr. Putin.
Well, it's a disaster for Putin in as much as, in a curious way, he's been basking in the glory of his successful seizure of Crimea, and that has raised his profile to kind of godlike status in Russia. He's at 83% in a reliable poll in terms of, and only 3% of the Russian people believe that the Malaysian airliner was shot down by Russian proxies using a Russian missile. So that shows you how successful he's been. But at the same time, you get the impression that he has a dilemma. He still wants to operate with the West. He's got so much money he and the Siloviki have stolen that they don't want to have it all confiscated. So, you know, he's sort of playing this game between these two poles and of nationalism and pragmatism. And he's the one that stirred up and unleashed this incredible fever pitch of nationalism. So I don't see how he can ride that tiger. And he has to have a fig leaf, in other words. If he wants to get out of this mess, doesn't he have to have a fig leaf?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, remember, I mean, Putin's calculation, I think, you know, this is based on what we surmise, was that these terrorist forces, these Russian proxies, and of course Russians, they're not just proxies, they're actually Russian forces, would succeed in mobilizing the local populations of eastern Ukraine, and eventually that would lead to some kind of new government, some kind of overthrow of the Ukrainian army, and so on. And the result of that would have been another province or two would have become annexed to Russia. Well, instead, these militants have turned out to be a disaster. I mean, the regions they've controlled have been terrorized. They've engaged in wanton destruction of civilian populations, civilian targets, of infrastructure, and the rest. And the general experience has been that when any village, town, or city has been liberated by the Ukrainian army, the people breathe a sigh of relief. It's not to say that they necessarily love Kiev, but they've discovered they hate these militants. So the Ukrainian army is pushing them back. The local population isn't exactly enthusiastic. And Mr. Putin's grand plan of somehow seizing or developing control over these two Ukrainian provinces is falling apart as we speak. And at the same time, as you said, he's whipped up this frenzy of hyper-nationalism. I mean, the sorts of things that the Russian media have been engaging in, the kinds of shows, the kinds of mendacity, the kind of manipulation that they engage in, are frankly reminiscent of Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia. It's that bad. It's never been that bad over the last 25 years, and it wasn't even that bad in the last 10 or 15 years of the Soviet Union's existence. Putin has essentially propelled Russia back into the Stone Age. And now he's got to deliver. I mean, he's promised the sky to the population. I think even more of a concern, frankly, to him isn't so much the population per se. I mean, this is a guy who doesn't care about people. It's the so-called Siloviki to which you referred to. Those are the 2,000 to 3,000 individuals, mostly from the KGB, the military, and other security forces, who form the core of his elite and who form the core of his support. Some of these guys must be wondering, you know, what the hell has Putin done? He promised us the world, and instead, he seems to be delivering something resembling defeat. So, given this kind of dilemma that he's facing, engaging in a kind of humanitarian mission and perhaps building upon the goodwill that that might generate, and he might be able, perhaps, as you say, to develop a fig leaf, a way out of this particular dead end. I mean, it's conceivable. Unfortunately, as I said, we just don't know. The guy's a bit of a loose cannon, and this may mean something positive for him, for Ukraine, for the eastern Ukrainian regions, and arguably for the world, or it may simply be another one of his subterfuges.
So, given what's at stake, though, with the Siloviki and the riled up Russian population, and the fact that the Russian nationalists are in a fever pitch, and there's an awful lot of people to the right of Putin, as bad as he may be, That's a huge concern. And then, you know, if there's to be a fig leaf, it has to be, he can't sell out his proxies. He can't reverse this enormous propaganda machine that he's ginned up. Do you think that there's anything that the U.S. and the West could do to help him with a fig leaf, to make it look like a victory and not a defeat?
Well, you know, the solution to the crisis has always been very simple, and it's been simple from day one. I mean, all Putin has to do is meet with the Ukrainian President Poroshenko. If he likes, he could meet together with Obama and Merkel and a bunch of other Western leaders. He could bring in the President of Belarus if he desires. It doesn't really matter. But the bottom line, the Ukrainian and the Russian presidents should meet. And the deal was very simple. I mean, both can then say, look, there's this awful humanitarian catastrophe. The world is coming to an end in eastern Ukraine. Something's got to be done. They both can reassert or assert their love of humanity, blah, blah, blah. Putin can, of course, genuflect toward human rights and all sorts of things like that. And in order to facilitate a humanitarian solution to this looming catastrophe, Putin withdraws the proxies, and at the same time, Ukraine commits itself to provide maximum decentralization and authority to the region in question. The two sides can then sign some kind of deal whereby they provide economic assistance to the region. The U.S., Germany, and a bunch of other countries can kick in a few million dollars as well, and everybody comes away looking good and smelling good. Can Putin do this? He could easily do this. By the way, I'm not so sure that he cannot unturn this propaganda machine. I mean, remember, he whipped up this hysteria. There's no reason why he couldn't whip it down a bit, maybe not overnight, but the propaganda machine is so massive, and the gullibility of the Russian population has been so enormous as well, that a slight switch in the kind of message that Putin would be sending to them could make an enormous difference.
Well, but in 2 weeks' time, Alexander Model, the Dutch will be announcing the inquiry into the shootdown of that plane, and it's obviously it was done by Putin's proxies using a Russian missile. So I don't know how he's going to dodge that bullet. You know, and given that the level of the nationalism, it's pretty hard to back down from that without some kind of victory. That's what concerns me. Is it he's going to be hit two ways? He's going to lose his war in Ukraine, and he's going to be blamed for this hideous humanitarian catastrophe of shooting down a civilian airliner. So. Anyway, we've run out of time. I'm sorry. Any quick last word?
Well, everything is in Putin's hands. That's really the bottom line.
Well, Alexander Model, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Alexander Model. He's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as the associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory, and is the author of The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.